is number 22-13340, Sedona Partners LLC versus Able Moving and Storage, Inc. Ms. Fahimi, am I correct that you saved 5 minutes for rebuttal?
No, I saved 2, I believe.
Okay. Well, it doesn't add up to 15. Oh, you're splitting your time. Okay. I'm sorry. Yes, 2 minutes. Got it.
I think it's perhaps the 3 minutes for my colleague that's been set aside.
That's correct. I'm sorry. Yes.
No problem.
You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning again, and may it please the court. Sarvanaz Fahimi, along with my colleague Kevin Boutan, on behalf of Relator and Appellant Sedona Partners LLC today. As briefed in detail, the heart of this litigation, which I'm not going to rehash, the heart of this litigation is about a policy called the America First policy. Behind the Department of State's handling relocation of employees and their families that work for the Department of State through a GSA program that's referred to as CHAMP, the CHAMP program. Here, the district court denied defendants' motion to stay discovery after taking, as this circuit often does, a preliminary peek at the allegations that were later set forth, finding that under Rule 9b, under that preliminary peek, there seemed to be enough to proceed, and thus denied the motion to stay. But subsequently, the district court determined that materials that were obtained by Relator during discovery could not be included in the second amended complaint.
Can I ask you just a quick question? There's been a lot of debate in the papers about our unpublished decision in Bingham. I assume you acknowledge that Bingham is effectively on point. And your contention is, fine, Bingham is wrong.
Yes, I would say overall the answer to that would be yes, except with the caveat in terms of on point. I think there were some differences in terms of the allegations and what the court was looking at and the sufficiency of those allegations.
But if Bingham were a published decision, you might be in some deep trouble.
Well, I would still say it was wrongly decided. I'd be presenting that here today.
But you'd need 12 of us to agree with you instead of 3 of us, right?
Yes, yeah. But I would say it's also factually distinguishable. Okay. That would be our belief.
Okay.
So in addition to that, the ruling at issue here that I believe you're referring to, Your Honor, seemingly to us contradicting logically the denial of that motion to stay discovery, to your point, what we briefed a lot about, the omnibus ruling that the district court set forward, we believe is flawed for a couple of main reasons. One, in striking the allegations under Rule 12 from that were obtained from discovery, the district court ignored the plain language of the federal rules of civil procedure to further, I believe, what was referred to as the goals of Rule 9b, the goals and kind of the policy behind 9b. In adding requirements to that, to the clear mandates of the FRCP, the district court also, as we just touched on and we argued in the briefing, relied entirely on Bingham versus HCA Inc., which is an unpublished decision of the court, and treated it as a mandate. And we also believe it was factually.
The district court really didn't do an analysis of Bingham, like to go through the factors to see if it was accurate. or a good decision, since it's not precedential in value.
Correct, yeah, at most it should have been given persuasive authority, and if we look at the order of the district court and even the underlying report and recommendation, but certainly the omnibus order, which I think is document 265, there's reference repeatedly to it being a mandate. You know, we have to basically follow Bingham, to address your point, Your Honor. On the first major point that we just talked about here in striking the allegations derived from discovery, as a question was posed, as we understand it, by this court in document 99 from this court, whether a rule prohibiting the use of information learned from discovery improperly supplements rules of civil procedure, our view is absolutely yes to that first point. And we would go further in saying that such a prohibition is directly contrary to the plain language, not just a supplement. And that would include relevant here, we believe, Rule 12F that we just talked about, Rule 8, Rule 9B, Rule 26, and Rule 15 on amendment. And as the cases this court pointed out in Document 99 illustrate, and other cases do as well, perceived policy concerns and goals cannot be the grounds to supplement or kind of rewrite the rules of civil procedure or any statute for that matter. Very briefly, for example, in Hill versus McDonough that the court cited in Document 99, where a prisoner challenged the form of execution but not the execution itself, the Supreme Court had to determine if this was another writ for habeas or if it could be viewed as what the prisoner was alleging, a Section 1983 action. In acknowledging that courts cannot or should not tolerate abusive litigation tactics, and obviously that's something very important, the Supreme Court held that nevertheless, the additional challenge was not foreclosed because it did qualify as a 1983 claim despite lacking the prisoner putting forth an alternative execution method. Specifically, the Supreme Court cited Rules 8 and 9 of the federal rules and relating to, quote, traditional pleading requirements for Section 1983 claims, stating specific pleading requirements are mandated by the federal rules of civil procedure and not as a general rule through case-by-case determinations of the federal courts. Similarly, just briefly, the other case referred by this court in Document 99, Jones versus Bach, dealing with exhaustion of administrative remedies, the Supreme Court there noted that, quote, Rule 8C of the federal rules is non-exhaustive, so that exhaustion can be another affirmative defense. And it was looking at the Prison Litigation Reform Act in that context and stating that that act was silent on how that had to be pled and whether exhaustion had to be used as an affirmative defense by the defendant or if plaintiff had to bring it in their initial pleading. And there, again, they looked at and they said, there's no issue here. We're going to follow Rule 8C and the traditional requirements. It can be an affirmative defense brought by the defendant. Your pleading plaintiff is not failing because of that. And, quote, that adopting different and more onerous pleading rules to deal with particular categories of cases should be done through established rulemaking procedures, not case by case. You know, basically saying, again, Rule 8 would apply.
Can I ask you a question about this case? And I'll ask your colleague on the other side the same question. So in the chronology here, district court denies the motion to stay discovery. Discovery proceeds, grants leave to amend. You then amend. And I guess maybe from the district court's perspective, the mistake you made was in filing the amended complaint, you actually referenced, maybe you had cites at the end of sentences or something. We learned this in this discovery, you know, citing to this piece of discovery, this piece of discovery, this piece of discovery. What if instead you had just filed an amended complaint that just like asserted all of this stuff upon information and belief or whatever? It seems like from the district court's perspective, that would have cured all the problems. Like if you just filed a big long complaint with a bunch of assertions in it, but you didn't sort of like come clean and say, hey, we found out this stuff in discovery, then the district court wouldn't have minded. Is that right?
I don't I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think, first of all, it would have been obvious, and certainly we wouldn't want to misrepresent anything to the court. And I think the other side, as they pointed it out, we're going to argue that anyway. Hey, look, this is new stuff because three of the defendants gave it to us, right? So they're saying this is new information we provided under document request. And these other items are clearly from a company they're aware of, Maersk, a non-party, et cetera. So I don't think that could have been avoided. And I don't believe, my understanding is not they based it on because there was citation, because I think that could have easily been fixed. I think the bottom line was for them, and the way we read their ruling and based on Bingham, is that substantively you just cannot use these items.
What's weird about that to me is then the problem seemingly isn't the fact that discovery went forward. If the district court would have stricken the new allegations anyway, would have annihilated the new allegations anyway, whether they were based on discovery or not, then the problem isn't really that discovery went forward. It's just that you amended your complaint as the district court authorized you to do. It seems like the district court's problem must have been trying to remedy its own decision in allowing the discovery to go forward, to kind of put that genie back in the bottle. I just don't really understand why it would be preferable from the district court's perspective to you for you to file an amended complaint as you were authorized to do, but for it to be naked as opposed to based on facts. That just seems upside down to me. Am I making any sense at all?
We agree with you. it's not logical to us, with all due respect to the district court, that a motion to stay came, they took a peek at the allegations, they decided not to stay based on those initial allegations in the First Amendment complaint. There was no order saying, by the way, you can't use the discovery, which again would be nonsensical, so I think that's why it's not in the order. And then we're given leave to amend, and we use some of those new facts to supplement that amendment, and we're told we can't use it.
So really the only basis for the district court judge to strike the, I'm going to call it the newly discovered evidence that you incorporate into the amended complaint, is Bingham. That's it.
Yes, and specifically what I will note about that, it was just Bingham, and in terms of, it was under 12F, right? So it was a motion to strike. And as we know, 12F, and kind of going back to the original point on what is the clear language of the FRCP or any statute, but the FRCP, 12F has specific categories: immaterial, scandalous, impertinent, redundant, going off my memory. They granted it on 12F, but there was really no analysis of how those terms, those specific enumerated terms, even applied. And if you go back and you look at Bingham, and you look at the district court's decision in Bingham, which this district court relied on Bingham, but the district court underlying decision in Bingham cited striking under 12F as, quote, immaterial, and cited back to Clausen to support that. But if you go back and look at Clausen and the cite they provide there, they're not talking about striking. They're not talking about the definitions under 12F. They're talking about kind of this policy concern under 9B, right? But they certainly don't discuss striking or discovery coming out or anything like that. So Bingham didn't have any support for that. And the clear language of 12F provides no support for the notion that these allegations could be, quote, immaterial or fall under the other enumerated categories of 12F. Similarly, there's nothing in Rule 9B that we mentioned. 15, we've cited case law from other circuits that have looked at that as well, that none of those rules, anything in the language, even comes close to stating that there'd be grounds for not allowing this discovery here. So I don't know if I'm out of time or do I get to keep going a little bit if I have some questions, or am I out?
You're out of time. You're over time.
Shoot. Okay. Can I just add one case reference? No.
You'll have a chance on rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Kevin Boutin on behalf of Sedona Partners, LLC. I'm just going to briefly address defendant's argument that even with the stricken material, the second amended complaint wasn't adequately pleaded, and specifically on the issues of submission of false or false claims or false statements, falsity, materiality, and scienter. The relator brings a claim, first cause of action for presentment of false claims, and second cause of action for making or using false statements materially connected to claims for payment to the government. The waiver requests themselves provide the foundation for the second cause of action for making or using false statements. And there's no dispute that the waivers were alleged with sufficient particularity. But for either claim, no specific evidence of invoices is required. All the relator needs to plead are reliable indicia that claims for payment were submitted to the government.
Can I ask you a quick question? And I guess maybe it's tangentially related to materiality. This is just a curiosity of mine about your case, and it may be the dumbest question in the world. But if the use of foreign flag vessels is cheaper, how is it that that's defrauding the government? Like, what's the damage?
Yes. So the issue there is that Congress has made a choice to use U.S. flag vessels for a number of reasons. For a long period of time, this has been the policy. And so this court has found that in a pleading, there's not a relator is not required to plead specific damages. And damages can be calculated based on the difference of what the government would have paid if they knew that, if they knew the truth, basically. So,
and there's, I guess maybe it's not all that relevant to what we're talking about here, but there is some damages model that will suggest that the government somehow is out of pocket by virtue of the use of foreign flag vessels that are cheaper.
So the reasoning is that the government would not have paid for these particular shipments
at all. Got it.
That's our position.
Fine.
Yes.
Okay.
And as I see my time is running a bit low, I wanted to address the issue that defendants' arguments regarding scienter in the briefing are largely based on the Safeco case, which the Supreme Court previously applied some language from, or some case law language from the FRCA to the false claims context, finding that scienter can be found based on an objective standard, but the Supreme Court has since issued an opinion in 2023 in the case Super Value, which determined that it's truly a, or it's actually a subjective standard for scienter and False Claims Act cases. So, point being, the reasoning in the courts below and the reasoning in the defendant's briefing are based on a standard that's no longer relevant to False Claims Act cases. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Noam Fishman, and I'm counsel for Cartwright International Van Lines. I'm speaking for all of the appellees this morning. I'm here with my co-counsel, Krista Fiore, and with Robert Borak, who's counsel for Paramount. But Mr. Borak has ceded his time to me. The court has asked the parties to address the question of whether a rule prohibiting a relator from using information in an amended complaint learned during discovery and properly supplements the federal rules. In asking this question, the court relies on Jones v. Bach and Hill versus McDonough. And the answer to that question is no. First, the cases that the court cites are not cases that address fraud. They're not cases that address the False Claims Act. And they're not cases that address Rule 9b. Second, upholding the district court's decision here is necessary to ensure that the relator honors its obligations under Rule 90. In contrast, the Hill, Jones, and other cases that they cite, in those cases, the lower courts acknowledge that the correct pleading standard was Rule 8A. Put another way, the lower courts in Jones and Hill were raising the bar beyond that which was required by Rule 8A. In this case, the district court was merely enforcing the existing Rule 9B and applying the 11th Circuit's precedent of Clausen, Atkins, Mestige, and others.
So can I ask you a quick question just about the procedural history of this case? And I'm sorry that I've just forgotten this, but did you, when the district court denied the motion to stay discovery, did you seek reconsideration of that before the district court?
I don't believe we did, Your Honor.
Because I have to confess, this feels to me, as I communicated earlier with my genie and bottle analogy, but it feels to me like buyer's remorse, either by you or the district court, for having denied that motion. And it is just strange to me, having denied the motion to stay discovery, so discovery proceeds, and then having granted a motion for leave to amend, why it is that it is somehow better to allow the amended complaint supplemented by real facts in the real world, found out through discovery, than it would be to allow an amended complaint based on raw assertion. That seems weird.
I understand your question, Your Honor. I think the issue is that there's a lot of reasons why a district court might opt not to stay discovery. Dockets are crowded. District court judges are under pressure to move cases forward. And I have no doubt at the time that the district court judge decided not to stay discovery, the judge believed it was the best path for this case. But that didn't change the pleading obligations under Rule 9b. It didn't change the obligations in order to state a cognizable claim, presentment claim under the False Claims Act, or a make-in-use claim under the False Claims Act.
What's the usual, and I just don't know the answer to this, what's the usual remedy for a 9b violation? Is it dismissal with prejudice or dismissal without prejudice to file a better complaint?
So ordinarily, Your Honor, I believe most circuit courts, including this one, allow a relator one time to appeal. Some
appeal or file an amended complaint?
File an amended complaint.
Yeah.
I believe the rule in this circuit is that one amended complaint is required. Beyond that, it's the court's discretion.
So again, sort of back to my question, if the one chance that you get to amend your complaint, now you can either, based on raw assertion, file a better complaint that complies with 9b, or you can file a complaint that happens to be informed by facts in the real world that complies with 9b. Why is the former better than the latter, vis-a-vis 9b?
I understand, Your Honor. I think it has to do with the fact that a relator is supposed to come forth with claims with particularity that fraud has occurred. It's the inherent nature of a fraud claim. It's the reputational harm that come with fraud.
Right, so I get it. So the initial complaint comes in. You file a 9B motion. The district court says, not specific enough, dismissed without prejudice, file a better complaint. Then there are two things that might happen. Either the relator, the plaintiff, comes back with a better complaint that's based on raw assertion. It's longer, it's more detailed, whatever, but it's supported by nothing. Or they file a complaint that makes all the same allegations and happens to be supported by real facts in the real world. Why is that one worse than the first one? It sounds like the first one would be hunky-dory.
Correct, Your Honor, except that Rule 9b is a gatekeeper, right? Clausen and a litany of cases since then in this circuit have said that Rule 9b serves a purpose to make sure that a relator comes forward with real facts that are known to the relator based on their position vis-a-vis the defendant, and can articulate with particularity each element of a fraud claim. And in this particular case, it's especially fraught because we don't even know who the relator is. The relator is hiding behind a LLC veil. We asked in discovery for the relator to identify itself, and it refused.
It sounds like you're arguing for a more onerous pleading standard in the case of a False Claims Act case for relators, and that seems contrary to what the Supreme Court said in Jones and Hill, which is that you can't apply the rule on a case-by-case basis.
I would disagree, Your Honor. We're advocating for 9b to apply equally to a relator as any other fraud plaintiff. We're saying that in order to plead fraud...
But any other fraud plaintiff, I mean, you're allowed to amend, and if during the course of discovery all of a sudden you learn information that makes your case even stronger on the other side, and you ask the court to amend the complaint, and this is your first time, and the court says yes, you're allowed to do that. I mean, you're not going to be thrown out of court.
Your Honor, I'm not aware of that precedent. But in this particular...
I've never seen a case where a district court judge, you plead with some specificity, but maybe not enough specificity, and then you learn something in discovery, and you amend the complaint to add that,
and you're thrown out of court. For what purpose? It wouldn't be immaterial because it pertains to the fraud.
Your Honor, a plaintiff, under Rule 9b, a plaintiff has to have facts known to that plaintiff that supports the fraud.
I understand that, but this is my hypothetical. Is you have, upon information and belief, you allege in the complaint certain fraud that has occurred. And during the course of discovery, you learn additional evidence, and you amend the complaint to add that additional evidence. What district court is going to strike it as immaterial?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that they would under the 9b gatekeeping function. And in fact, Your Honor, under Ghost versus Native American Services Corporation this past summer, this court recognized that 9b is judged on pre-discovery material, stated in that decision. That's Ghost versus Native American Services Corporation.
But once the district court determines that the first complaint has enough to continue and allow some discovery, why isn't the purpose of 9b met there?
Because the district court did not do a fulsome analysis of 9b. It was really a threshold showing to allow the discovery to continue. The issue at that point was whether or not the case should move forward while the court considered pending motions to dismiss. If the court had intended for the case to move forward in full, why wouldn't have the court just denied the pending motions to dismiss without hearings? The court considered the pending motions to dismiss and actually granted it after it denied the stay of discovery. The court granted leave, considered the additional allegations, and then dismissed it a second time.
But I think the problem here is the district court interpreting the rule to prevent the use of material obtained in discovery in pleading. Right? The district court has discretion to do all sorts of things, not rule on motions, stay discovery, not stay discovery. But what we're concerned with here is interpreting the rule in such a way as to preclude this.
There's two issues here, Your Honor. I think first is if the court were to overturn this decision, I think it's sending a compelling message to district courts that they have to do a motion to dismiss 12b6 analysis every time it considers a motion to stay discovery. Otherwise, the motion to stay becomes absolutely moot.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
What would be the appropriate resolution if the case had gone like this? Complaint filed, you bring a 9B motion, you say not specific enough, the district court says, motion to dismiss granted, would leave to amend, and they come back with a 500-page complaint that dots every I, crosses every T, it hits every element. Should that complaint be dismissed under 9B?
I think under the Ghost decision and under Bingham, which is persuasive, not binding.
No, I'm saying without respect to the whole discovery shenanigans, forget about discovery. They filed a complaint, wasn't good enough. They were told to file another one. They filed another one, and boy, was it fulsome.
I think although it's hard to hear in this particular context as you've constructed the hypothetical, but if 9B is to have meaning, the answer to that is yes. It should be dismissed.
Then I think what you're telling me is that the remedy on a 9B motion is always dismissed with prejudice. Because in my hypothetical, that it's dismissed without prejudice, they're given leave to file an amended complaint, they do, and it dots every T and crosses dots every I and crosses every T.
I agree with that, Your Honor, if the relator has been given an opportunity to amend. Obviously, if they've not been given,
yeah,
and you're hypothetical, they have been given.
Yeah. Just like in this case. So if that complaint survives the second 9B motion, right? When you bring your second 9B motion, it says even that 500-page complaint that dots every I and crosses every T still isn't good enough. And I think what you've told me is that motion should be denied because they've done well enough in round two. Back to my question. Is that right? Am I right about that? So here's the thing. They file a cruddy complaint. Complaint number one is no good. It's bad. You move to dismiss it under 9B. The district court says, you know what, you're right, this is not a very good complaint, but I'm going to give them leave to amend, just like it did here. They come back with a second, with an amended complaint. And round two is the 500-page complaint that dots every I and crosses every T and hits every element, right? Okay. Can that complaint be dismissed under 9B?
if that 500 allegations, 500 pages of allegations yeah. that hit the essential elements of the False Claims Act are predicated on discovery, it can be discussed.
Okay, then this is, I'm just going to put all my cards on the table. That makes no sense to me. What you're telling me is that they can file an unsupported second complaint that's just chock full of assertions backed by nothing, and that survives 9B. But oh, if they cite discovery, now everything has changed. They've cited real facts in the real world, and we're going to dismiss that one? That seems 180 degrees wrong to me.
Well, but you're right. I don't agree with the premise of that question, because you can't definitionally under 9B. The particularity requirement mandates that you can't just make it up upon information and belief and hit the elements. You have to have facts to support each essential element.
But somehow if you cite discovery responses, they're no longer facts? That doesn't make any sense?
Well, Your Honor, if I could pivot, because I see my time is just to one other aspect, because I think to the extent that
I think you should answer the question, because it I don't really understand how you can say that you... It seems to me what you're really saying, bottom line, is that you only get one chance to file a complaint, and that's it.
No, Your Honor, you do get a second chance, but that second chance has to be based upon information that you have in your possession or control, not information that you learn through discovery.
What if you learned from there's another ongoing litigation somewhere else in another state? And you read that complaint and you learn it and you talk to somebody there. Are you saying that that would qualify as discovery, or that's just pre-discovery that you're doing, talking to other witnesses in another case?
If you conduct your own investigation, Your Honor, if you have your own affidavits or whatever mechanism, modality you use to get the, then that would be valid. But if you conduct discovery, if you're going to go to the courthouse and use that as the means to get access to the records of the...
Why would this be... It sort of seems if the district court allows for discovery, why wouldn't this be like a bill of discovery where you're allowed to go to federal court and ask for a bill of discovery before filing a lawsuit?
I don't think under the False Claims Act you have that mechanism. The government has that ability under a civil investigative demand, a CID. But there's case law about the availability of CID materials and how there's a joint prosecution interest between the government and that's different. But if you go to court and you use that modality to gain access to defendant's records, I think the case law is pretty clear in the circuit that that's not valid under Rule 9B. That's not.
Are you saying for all individuals or just under a False Claims Act?
Well, this case is limited to the False
Claims Act. No, but that's why I'm asking the question.
I think it applies to Rule 9B. Not everyone, not Rule 8. The pleading standards under Rule 8 are fundamentally different. But under 9B, I believe, Your Honor, that does apply. May I just pivot to the last point? Because to the extent there's a public policy issue, there's the court has trouble with the logic of the district court. I would argue that this is not the case that the court needs to actually address this issue, because even with their quote-unquote prolux, which is a word that one of the, I think it's the Keeler decision uses for a large complaint, this case still hasn't alleged the fundamental elements of a False Claims Act violation. A present claim or plot requires a claim for payment. In all of the allegations in the corrected Second Amendment complaint, there is no claim for payment alleged. And the precedent is clear that a claim for payment is required, and very quickly, they haven't alleged that with this transshipment requirement on the maker-use claim, they have not alleged that there was a ship on the other side of the transshipment that was actually available with space sufficient to meet the requirements of every single one of the shipments they allege in paragraphs 84 to 196. So even if the court were to find the district court erred in striking those allegations, they still have not fulfilled the fundamental pleading obligations under a False Claims Act.
Thank you, Mr. Boutin.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that you uphold the district court.
Okay. I'm going to try to go very fast here. I've only saved 2 minutes. So what I wanted to just hit on before very quickly is this circuit also applied Jones and Hill in the case recently, 2023, Smith versus Williams. I believe we provide a copy to everyone. And again, that wasn't even about Rule 8 or Rule 9. That was Rule 41 about dismissal and how those policy concerns cannot override the plain language of the statute. And we disagree, again, respectfully with my colleague across the aisle or the podium here, Jones versus Bach and Hill, those are Supreme Court mandates. It's not just limited to Rule 9 versus Rule 8. The court was very clear there. You can't read in pleading requirements. You can't heighten, you can't change pleading requirements. Didn't say this only applies to Rule 8. It was very specific. And on a bigger policy front, they were talking about the fact you can't override the plain text that's at issue. Four policies, four goals. So those cases apply here. And the district court here ignored the Supreme Court's mandate. It's against those mandates and 11th Circuit case law that I just cited. Also, in terms of 9B and the purpose of 9B that was just cited, yes, to give notice to defendants, avoid frivolous claims, et cetera. There's nothing, again, in 9B that talks about whether you can use discovery or not. That simply is not being addressed by the other side here. And that's not in the case law. That's not anywhere. And this is going beyond 9B. It's going into a whole other realm of requiring additional things, not just particularity. In terms of the identity, that's a red herring of the relator, and no relief was sought on that as far as I'm aware. That's not what the elements of 9B are. The court also, when it took a peek, I want to address what was said, looked at Clausen specifically. So 9B was evaluated at that initial peek. The Ghost, the case that was just cited, that case actually, in passing, refers to pre-discovery. It's not part of the holding. There's no analysis on striking or there's...
We're out of time, Ms. Fahimi. Thank you. Our last case...